Part 3. Questions 21 to 25. Today we're going to look at the life and some of the works of one of America's finest modern female poets, Sylvia Plath. At the time of her death in 1963, Sylvia Plath was on the verge of the critical success and recognition that she had sought for most of her life. Her first novel, The Bell Jar, had just been published, and the publication of her collection of poems, Ariel, had just been agreed. These poems, which were mostly written during the last year of her life, chronicled the traumatic developments taking place in her personal life and were to make for her a reputation as a first-rate poet. But it wasn't until 1982, almost 20 years after her death, that her posthumously published collected poems won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature. Since this time, the fascination and intrigue with her work has continued to grow. Very few modern poets have captured the popular imagination as much as Plath, even to the extent that in 2003, a movie was made about her life and her intense relationship with husband and fellow poet Ted Hodges. To understand the continued growth and interest in her work, we have to look at the issues which her life and work address. As Susan Bassnett writes in her book on women writers, "Dying as she did in 1963, Sylvia Plath never knew that so soon afterwards the problems of what and how women write was to become such a crucial matter and was to be debated by so many other women." So, Sylvia Plath was a woman writing about women's issues before they were recognized as being of any importance. Sylvia Plath was born at Robinson Memorial Hospital in Boston on 27 October 1932. She was the firstborn child of Otto and Aurelia Plath, both highly educated academic people. Her father, Otto, was a professor of biology at Boston University, but her mother had been subjugated into a domestic role as a housewife despite her level of education. Her father was not too pleased with the birth of his daughter and demanded that his wife have a son within the next 2 years. Amazingly enough, his wife obliged by giving birth to a son almost exactly 2 years later.
Questions 26 to 30. Hello, class. So today we're going to be looking at facial recognition and to the different sorts of technology that go into facial recognition. Now, before we start, can any of you tell me where we can see facial recognition in action? Yes, you at the back?
In the TV show Las Vegas.
Yes, well, you're right. In this popular TV show, the security team pull images of the individuals from their surveillance system and run the image through a database to identify the person. In that way, all the card counters and blacklisted gamblers can be escorted from the poker tables. It looks easy on TV, but in the real world, facial recognition is a tricky business. So let's start with the more traditional methods of facial recognition. Every phase has peaks and valleys, and they can be translated into what is termed as nodal points. Each face has about 80 of these, and they include distance between the eyes, the length of the jaw, the width of the nose, things like that. These measurements can be used to create a numerical code, and this is called a face print. This system is good because it can compare two-dimensional images, such as photographs. The problem is that the images have to be controlled. The person has to be staring straight at the camera. There must be no variance in facial expression or lighting because any variance in these parameters reduces the effectiveness of the system. So they had to come up with another way. So the new way of recognizing faces is by using a 3D model. It has better accuracy, allegedly. 3D imagery detects distinctive features in the face, such as the curves of the eyes, nose, and chin, features which do not change over time. These are measured at the sub-millimeter level. Interestingly, a 3D image can be taken not only from a live scan, but also from a 2D photograph. And another good thing about the 3D system is that it can recognize a person from a range of angles. The person doesn't have to be directly facing the camera, as in 2D technology. Once again, the system gives each individual a unique code, a set of numbers that represents the face. It's easy to match a 3D image to another 3D image if you already have a 3D image in your database. It's less easy to match 3D images to 2D images, but what they can do is pull certain measurements from the 3D image, such as size of the eye and so forth, and use this to convert the 3D image into a 2D image, and this image can be more easily compared to the 2D images in the database. But it's not just the measurements which can be used to recognize faces. There's also a new development called skin biometrics. This uses the uniqueness of skin texture to get its results. The process takes a picture of a patch of skin, and the system will then identify any pores, lines, moles, blemishes, and other features of skin texture. This method can be used to identify identical twins, something that cannot be done with the 3D technology. Its other advantages over 3D imagery are that it's insensitive to changes in expression, blinking, smiling, and so forth, and can compensate for changes in facial features, such as the growth of a beard or wearing glasses. It's not perfect, though, as it is sensitive to lighting conditions and poor camera resolution, and if there is glare from the sun. So now we've covered the main types of facial recognition. We'll move on to its uses. Now, has anybody here?
Good morning, everyone. Now, in today's lesson, I'd like to talk about population growth, and in particular, fertility rate. Now, can anyone here define fertility rate?
Is it the number of births in a population measured per 1,000 people per year?
No. That's what we call the birth rate. The number of children born in a year per 1,000 people. No, the fertility rate is the average number of children born per woman in her lifetime. That is, if she lives beyond her childbearing years. Now, do you think the British fertility level is higher or lower than it was, say, 20 years ago?
I think it's lower, because these days women are far more focused on their careers than they used to be.
Well, that point is certainly true, but actually, fertility levels in Britain are relatively high at the moment. In 2008, it was 1.96. That means that, on average, each woman gives birth to 1.96 children. And in 2009, it was only slightly lower at 1.94. The last time fertility rates were this high was back in 1973. In the UK currently, the highest rate of fertility is in Northern Ireland, where the rate is 2.04. And the lowest is in Scotland, where the rate is just 1.77.
I don't understand. How come fertility rate is going up? Women are just as career-driven these days as they were 30 years ago.
Well, the reason is that during the 1990s, women really started to delay having families. And that was the reason for the decrease in birth rate then. Now those women are in their 30s and early 40s, and they are starting to have families, so that's why the birth rate is going up.
Oh, I see. So it's not actually as if people are actively choosing to have more children than they used to.
Yes, that's right, Charlene. The number of children per family is continuing to fall. Women who are currently in their 70s had an average of 2.4 children. Those in their 60s had 2.2, those in their 50s had 2.0, and the current figure is 1.9. Actually, this figure isn't due to more families choosing to have only one child, although that certainly is occurring. It's mainly because of the increasing number of women who have no children at all. This figure was 1 in 10 among the age group who are now 65, but now 1 in 4 women in their mid-40s are childless.
I heard that the fertility rate in Europe is like really low, 1.3 or something.
That's right, Charlene, it is. It's far below the replacement level. Can you tell me what replacement level means? No? It's the number of births you need to keep the population constant.
Yes, I heard that in France they're trying to get people to have more children. They even give out gold medals if you have 8.
That's right. So we've already mentioned that women are waiting before having children because of their careers. Why else is fertility rate generally decreasing?
I think they have fewer children because they're so expensive. I mean, I heard one report that said it costs £200,000 a year to raise a child here, but I find that difficult to believe. People's standard of living is far higher now than it used to be 100 years ago when families had 8 or 9 kids.
That's very true, but these days, people's expectations tend to be higher. Parents want their children to have the best opportunities in life, so they're prepared to pay to develop their children's talents.
Yes, I heard that in China, where they're easing off some of the rules of the one-child policy and allowing some couples to have 2, many parents are still choosing to have 1. They say it's just too expensive. But, you know, I reckon that with all this parental micromanagement that's going on these days, parents only have the time to manage 1 or 2 children.
That's a good point. So now I'd like to look at some different organizations and examine what they believe about the current population issues.